It's definitely an art, you know, a craft to hang out in a kind of a conversational format and you could say maintain or sustain a certain quality of attention.
Well, and there's like this, it's just, I don't know, like a virus or just, I don't know what the anthropomorphization of everything is really rampant. Like I get like really excited when Peter talks about tarot cards because I'm always like, what is he talking about? That is not anything that I, you know, get from anything else. And I'll go trying to look around for more of that sort of information, and it's in like, you know, embedded in sort of Aleister Crowley and all these other stuff, but it's really hard to dig out.
Oh yeah, very
It
hard.
still sounds kind of anthropomorphized, even though that might not be what he's referring to, but you know, it's like really hard to dig out. And anyone that has since seemed to write about it, it's back to that same like persona. It's a personification. It's like, what would this personality be like? It's like, no, that's not it's not what they're talking about. But it's so, it's just, it doesn't seem to be very prevalent.
No, his keen approach to tarot and you know, plucking curious memes out of thin air is a good one.
Well, there's not a lot of places to look for guidance, is kind of what I was getting at. It's not just the tarot, but in terms of having a conversation that's not completely and totally kind of anthropomorphized and framed that way, you know, about humans and whatever, is rare. And so there's not, it's like, it's so easy to get kind of sucked back into that because you start, if you like, you know, go out and look for things, that's mostly seems to be what you find, you know?
Well, yeah, you know, even popular teachers, you know, elicit or speak to someone's emotional condition, you know, as a way of soothing our existential despair. You know, like Jeff Foster.
Yeah, nobody really zooms out far.
No, he,
Nobody.
it's, you know, he talks about the same old, you know, your anger, your depression, your sadness, your this, your that. It's like all he can seem to do is use psycho-emotional discomfort and mood states as a handle for, you know, some kind of emancipation. And everyone is so, you know, narcissistically overwhelmed by their mood states, by their emotions and their mood states and their various sorrows, that, you know, someone like Jeff Foster might appear as a breath of fresh air. Oh, he's speaking about me, or he's speaking to me, and hopefully I can transmute my narcissistic interest and my crappy mood states into something like enlightenment. You're like, good luck.
That's really just kind of like seems like this kind of maybe this is just me, I don't know, underlying like wanting to be kind of special and stand out when you feel because you feel really mediocre or like an ant, like in your you know, you just feel like this kind of like you're not, you know, this radiant bliss field, you're just this mediocre little turd floating along in your daily little life, and it, you know, so when someone comes along, does anything gives you attention or. You know.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that's right. I mean, our Achilles heel is what? Seeking attention through you know, dramatization. because we, you know, it's not, let's not, we weren't raised with any emphasis on emotional maturity. We were, you know, raised under the influence of our parents' own narcissistic, selfishly driven drama field. So we figure, oh, that's what it looks like. That's how you give and receive attention or give and receive affection. By negotiating in a hellacious drama field. We take that all the way into our adult lives, you know, and it's like, oh gosh, really, is that the best the species can do?
Yeah, well, and in like a very narrow bandwidth of whatever we've defined to be, you know, like your career and your, if you're a good person and are you doing good deeds, what have you done for charity, like just all this weird ridiculous stuff.
Yeah, it's a lovely,
with anything.
it's a provocative, exciting challenge to get off the cushion, attend to the presence of contemplative wisdom at hand, and discover what it's like to be human together or conversational together from that point of view, without emphasis on hypothetical situations or anecdotal hysteria or attention seeking through the drama field. I mean, where do you get the training? You don't get it at home. You don't get it, you know, in the educational system. You don't get it in the business place, you know, wearing business casual attire.
You don't get it at the yoga centers.
You don't get it at the yoga center. You don't get it at the meditation retreat house. It's like all of these places that apparently dedicate themselves to something as curious as liberation have no idea how to deal with a very fundamental and really wonderful challenge, which is, oh, this is awake and, you know, purportedly human at the same time that it's perfectly transhuman. And how do we have, let's say, fun, which is what we're after anyway, you know, engaging in the discovery or the exploration or the feeling tone of present-minded liberation.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that kind of does provide fun and intimacy and specialness in an instant without having to do or accomplish anything.
Yeah, it really can. It's fun.
It's just such a nicer way to hang out. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's fun to play with the model of, hey, this is awake and egalitarian. And so it doesn't have to be, you know, a single person doling out some kind of teaching. It can truly be you know, a shared exploration. Consciousness is vital. Consciousness is crazy. Consciousness is, you know, the giant puppy that will lick you into submission. I mean, it's also sacred and ineffable and, you know, always beyond itself from moment to moment as it's, you know, expressing itself even in the most mundane fashion.
Yeah, because there's nothing mundane about it. It's like...
Yeah, maybe that's why, right?
I mean, even if it feels mundane, it still is like, fuck.
Well, that's the yogic discovery. That's the, let's call it the arousal of interest in the rainbow body, or arousal of interest in the, you know, the astral or yogic body, is, oh, this can feel incredibly familiar, if not mundane, habitual, predictable, and depressing, while it is transcendent. So discovering the evidence of its transcendence pouring in and through, you know, the five senses and, of course, the movement of mind, the movement of discernment, the movement of sensitivity, which is unbound by space-time. It's all this. It's all present. People are looking for an evocative experience or an evocative event to occur to them when themselves, right, beingness itself is the evocative event. Maybe that's what the realizer starts to get, a very confident appreciation of. It's like, oh my goodness, this beingness, which is the ground, the carrier wave, you know, of all that's appearing, is awake, and tag, I'm it. It's like, where do we think we're going? What is it that we want to happen to give us some demonstration of the primacy of ourselves?
Yeah, because I feel most of the time like I'm not there. I'm not there yet, and that there's still something that needs repair in order to have that sensibility.
Yes. Let's for fun look at the geometry of that very, very common, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, very pejorative, right? I don't know. I think I make most of them up and hope that they might be real. so as not to be embarrassed.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, let's look at the mechanics of what body of evidence we use, subtle or gross, to convince ourselves of the condition that we're presently in, accuse ourselves of being of that condition, and worse, believe our own accusation. Right? So here we are dwelling in, let's say, a very familiar texture, right? So the boundary field of time, the boundary field of space, the boundary field of body, the room that I'm in, the mood that I'm having. I know myself. Maybe I'm comfortable with myself, maybe I'm uncomfortable with myself, but I know myself, and that familiarity, that you could say circumstantial familiarity with my mood, with my psychology, with my inner dialogue, with my language, makes it appear as if, oh, I'm the same as I was yesterday, or the same as I've, you know, always been. I am pretty much the most predictable, you know, boring, easily distracted person I know, and there's no way that that could be enlightenment. That's just me. That's just bullshit, right? Yeah. So, okay, that's cool. And what we fail to see, because it requires a little more something, maybe a little more craziness. Who knows what it requires? But even the familiarity of ourselves is appearing in what? It's like we don't have any sensitivity to the plasma in which we are occurring and coming up with a mundane accusation about our present condition. I miss the plasma completely, accuse myself of being less than some idealized notion of enlightenment. I believe the accusation, and so I remain, you know, perhaps heading for the carrot, that I'm looking for something other than what's presently familiar as evidence for something I would like to be someday. Okay, and that kind of, casual hallucination is A, not real, B, involuntarily arising, C, not true, but that's the same thing as saying not real. And so it behooves us to find a way to have a textural relationship with the plasma in which our own consciousness and our own mind and the content of that mind is occurring. That's where the portal to, let's say, perfect identity is. Because our typical experience is not one of perfect identity, but of being a creature extruded in space-time wandering about.
It's basically a bunch of half-assed assumptions that we take to be absolutely true and then just fucking run with them. I don't know.
Yeah, and
this is doing so.
Yes, and we pay far too much attention to the content of thought than the, can I say, the plasma. We think that the content of thought is actually capable of reporting accurately on my present condition. So when I self-accuse through the lens of familiarity, I think that's true. Then no wonder I think, oh, I'm not enlightened and my ship hasn't come in today because, shit, I'm still me. And that's...
I'm living and breathing through the five senses that I know and I'm aware of. How does that get me to stop chasing my own tail and recognizing this plasma field?
Yeah, well, you, I can appreciate the confidence that you may have when you say I'm living or existing through the five senses, you know, and the movement of thought, discernment, and association. So the question is, maybe that's partially true. Maybe that's not completely true. And can we, any one of us, get a sense of the, let's just call it the organic, non-consequential effulgence of beingness itself as the cauldron for the five senses, as the cauldron for time, as the cauldron for space, for thought, for ideation and accusation? Because this plasma is not tomorrow. The plasma, the word that we're, let's say, using this evening, is presence itself. Now, if I return to my to the thought process for evidence, I'm going to end up only in, right, the anecdotal, hypothetical, and referential images that thought is capable of generating. So one thing that needs to shift or will organically shift as we take up this task is that we start to shift loyalty from thought, the content of thought, the accusation of thought, the believability of thought, and we somehow feel ourselves. And that, of course, the feeling oneself is always present. It's never not present. It's just that we become so easily distracted by the movement of referential association, which is, right, the movement of thought, the internal dialogue. And even subtler than thought, you could say there are moods and fugues and feelings that, again, we pay a lot of attention to, but presume that they're static. We presume that we are statically appearing rather than dynamically appearing. And we're so easily bored with ourselves because we're paying so much attention to the symptoms.
But when you say shift from thought to feeling, you're not talking, when you say feeling, you're not talking about happy, sad, angry, ecstatic.
No. Yeah, no, that's right. We're not talking about feeling as an emotional quality. Yeah, because feeling, just like thought, is appearing in a, you know, a more profound cauldron. That's why we're using the word, for fun, plasma. everything is appearing in, you know, the plasma of experiencing. And thought is referential, so, you know, thought appears in the plasma of experiencing, but, you know, it's no different or has no more authority, let's say, than the breeze passing through a tree that somehow kept its leaves most of the winter and makes a beautiful rattling sound like a cosmic rattlesnake. I mean, thought is just another beautiful apparitional demonstration appearing in the plasma of consciousness itself. But we pay so much attention to thought as being an individuated legitimacy of meaningful and accurate reporting on reality. No wonder we're bored. No wonder it's easy for us to convince ourselves we're not enlightened.
Like, yeah, watching the crappiest news station all day long and thinking that's, like, what's going on all day.
Yeah, that's right. If you're watching Fox News day in and day out, no shit you're not enlightened.
And you're going to be bored, if you have any sense. I mean, some
yeah, that's right.
They are fulfilled or something, but...
I need to have Sean Hannity or, you know, that other asshole Bill O'Reilly screaming at me all day long. If I'm listening to Fox News all day long, then, you know, I mean, either I've got to go to Ramana Ashramam as quickly as possible or kill myself. So you can notice, you can discover that before you or one puts thought on a pedestal, you can feel that there is, let's call it, the quality of attention that is initially substantively present before thought has anything to say. In other words, you have to attenuate to thought for it to have any influence over your present experience. Now, the fact that you have the prowess and the magical gift of attenuating to thought suggests that, well, shit, that's not thinking. When you speak to yourself in your own mind, whether casually, subconsciously, or, you know, with fervent desire, there's the quality of attention needs to be present to animate thought. Otherwise, it just bubbles up, you know, like an oxygen bubbler in a fish tank, and no one pays it any attention. Yeah, so that's another great ingress or portal into beginning to see that you are of the nature of an attentive plasma, not of the nature of thinking, and that thinking has no power and has no grip, has no purchase, if it weren't for your attentivity animating thought. So feeling oneself would include, oh my goodness, attention is what's really running the show, not thought. And thought, like every other apparitional symptom, appears in the plasma noticed by attention. And attention is non-dual, because attention is not creating referential fabrication, right? Thought is referential fabrication. Attention is firsthand. There's no time lapse between attention and experience. Therefore, you know, attention is experience. I mean, I plagiarized this thing I heard Peter say, and I was like, it was funny. I was listening to a chat, and, you know, he said it, and it just kind of whizzed by most of the group that he was speaking to, because it was so such a casual remark, but it stunned me. I ran into a tree. And I was like, oh my God, of course. You get these beautiful kernels, you know, in your own mind or listening to him or whomever, where you glimpse the incredible, call it beauty, joy, or startle that this is non-dual, meaning attention is experienced. There's no time, there's no space, there's no lapse, there's no interloper, there's no interpreter. And that's what's present now. We know, you could say know, our present experience absolutely without an intermediary. But once we attenuate or give attention to thought, that creates the presumption, the felt sense of there being an intermediary. Yeah. And the intermediary is I, me, mine, right? Self. And the intermediary is a fabrication. And the intermediary is bored and suffers and is anxiety and apprehension ridden. And the intermediary is the sense of false entity, you would say, that wants to be enlightened. But that fabrication cannot be enlightened. Because if we follow the, let's just call it the yogic literature, enlightenment suggests the cessation of the fabrication of this entity. It's not like the entity gets enlightened. The attenuation that creates the myth of the entity shifts loyalty. And that's just as present right now as it has ever been since you were conceived or born or, you know, that's all that's present. It's the only thing that's present is this miracle of attention is experience. Ta-da! So what else could it be? It's already profoundly, profusely, beyond measure awake. But our job is to learn how to feel it or articulate it or play with it or, you know, bring to ruination our ideation about things. And that's why, you know, words like in self-inquiry and bullshit like that are used so that you can bring to bear the remarkable bandwidth of your present intelligence to look at what it is you think you're doing. And this is textural, right? It's feeling. Not, you know, emotional, though it can, of course, be accompanied by emotion, right? I mean, I could be angry. I could be frustrated. I can be despairing. Maybe in the guru's presence, I get a moment of peace and I can have, you know, gratitude and wonder and expansivity. And all of those things can be accompanied by, you know, emotions, right? Terrible and enviable. But whatever it is that's occurring is apparitionally appearing, impersonally appearing, spontaneously appearing, unconditionally appearing in the plasma of what we might refer to as now. And there is absolutely no intermediary. The intermediary is imagined, you could say, after the fact. Because all thought is either a projection or a report. Right? I mean, thought's creative, so I can imagine things that are not presently so, that either I resist or want to have occur. Or I could be thinking about what I think is presently so, but what I think about what is presently so is just an arbitrary fraction of what is actually presently so. Because you can't reduce an infinity to, right, linearity, a referential linearity such as thinking. You can't. Therefore, it's pretty safe to say everything that you tell yourself about yourself is an absolute lie. Everything that you tell yourself about everything, about anything, is an absolute lie. Because it's a fraction of the entirety. It's a fraction of the totality. And also, it's late.
But in this discovery, doesn't the intermediary still continue?
You could say the felt sense of the intermediary continues for as long as it continues. You know, you look at teachings that say initiation, you know, cultivation, stream entry, right? Deepening confidence in realization, then, you know, a shift of realization, and you know, whatever integration might mean to you. And so And all of those are presently. This moment is transmission. This moment is initiation. This moment is cultivation. This moment is yoga. This moment is realization. This moment is integration. And there's no chronology. Really, there's no chronology. There's no from this to that, then that to this, then this to that. It's like just, whoa, here we are. Here this is. So the sense of, an intermediary, as an I, me, my, that might be pining for enlightenment, if he or she had any fucking sense, let's say starts to get a deepening handle or a deepening glimpse of the plasma, not the effluent. And that understanding has never not been present. We just, no one encouraged us, to take a deeper look at it. No one encouraged us that the instinct that we have for non-dual confidence is already present and has always been present, right? When we're children, we're more or less treated like, circus ponies. And we're taught, naming, language and naming. And we don't get much of emotional training because we're raised by crazy people. We certainly don't get much spiritual training because our parents, they had no idea that a conversation like this was even possible. It's not like they didn't want to have the conversation. This conversation, as ordinary to us as it may be, for our parents, it doesn't even exist. It's not possible to have it. sometimes we lose sight of the things that we may take as, casual intonations into the adventure of awake are, may I say, somewhat mature yoga. We think, doesn't everyone talk this way? Doesn't everyone think this way? Isn't everyone interested in this? No. No, which is kind of a pity because you could say the whole humanity, which is so richly capable of miracles beyond, still remains after its, thousands years reign on Earth, pretty much dumbfuck.
Well, who knows? Maybe in the imagination of time, look what we were doing not too long ago, killing Jews and blacks and enslaving people. You couldn't have a conversation about, any of that either,
Yes. Yeah. Well taken. Our tendency toward violence and violation is a legend.
Well, it also evolved. It does seem to evolve in the imagination of time, right? In the same sense, when my parents were younger, racism was really prevalent. So the same conversation you could have today, they couldn't have then,
Yes, of course.
Stuff from that and whatever,
Yeah, how long ago was it that it was hard to find a yoga studio?
Not long.
Yeah.
They didn't grow
Now you trip over them.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean that namaste culture is all that helpful, but it's something.
No, I'm not. Yeah, I'm just saying it's more of a. No, never mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just am more thinking of like this, seems to like to imagine itself in time. It's something it does.
Sure.
And in order to do that, it has to create kind of a person, the past and a future. And
well, yes. I mean, you know, these are, of course, you know, legitimate and sensitive observations into the weird nature of things. But it, but of course, it's a slippery slope. You know, once we start, you know, accusing or suggesting why this does what it does or how it does what it does.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
In any fashion.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was just wondering why it appears to me that people who go through this psycho-emotional traumatization in which they seem to discover this awakened state, how that seems to happen for some people. I don't quite understand that. But, you know, people like Wayne, who's told stories of what happened to him and other people, how something right. traumatic has triggered something in them to bring yeah. them
yeah.
To or not to bring them somewhere, but for this sheath or facade of
yeah.
you know, life, living, to kind of drop away to see and experience this larger sense of
yeah,
what's really going on.
Yeah, you can hear there are catharsis stories that some like to tell, and there are, you know, very gentle, almost not even worth repeating stories that others have. Right, and then there are stories of people that had neither catharsis nor even interest in anything remotely spiritual that stumbled into awake somehow. Hmm. Yeah. I think it's unfortunately misleading and fetishizing to pay that much attention to these, you know, kind of catharsis stories where all of my egotism was washed away because I was, you know, this woman broke up with me, then that woman broke up with me, and I went into a fiery inferno from which I would never return and discovered nothing can hurt me, you know? Like, oh, hey, rock and roll. Who gives a fuck? I mean, I think it's more valuable, of course, this is just, you know, my experiential preference that, hey, this is awake, fuck you. That, I mean, what? That's, it's that simple. What are we talking about? There's no need for, you know, some kind of catharsis, some kind of preparation, some kind of purification. There's no need for anything to be a precursor to what this already is. This way we can take some of the drama, you know, and some of the lamentation off the table. And, okay, you're an adult. Probably not a very well-adjusted one, but welcome to the party. And as a very not very well-adjusted adult, you strangely can apply your native intelligence, your even transcendent intelligence, to glimpse the geometry and fabric of present consciousness. And let's agree, you know, the sometimes a certain kind of vocabulary can be handy in pointing toward the nuance of present experience, which very, very few people, you know, let's say do. I mean, we're that, you could say we're that generally dumb or so easily duped that we don't give any attention to the texture of the plasma in which all experiencing seems to be occurring, apparitionally arising. And with the slightest attention given to the curious nature of thought and thinking and universe creation, we can actually observe that it's occurring in us at present, which is kind of a miracle. You don't have to be on a cushion for 30 years to see that that we're creating certainty out of ambiguity, that we imagine time and space as boundary conditions, when our present experience is not bound by time or space.
But of course, imagine time and space. I mean, if all is really occurring in imagination in some sense, and that's what you are, and that's what this is.
That's right. Yes.
And it's not like you're going to, like, transcend the experience of time and space or anything, necessarily.
Well, that's part of the discovery that's yours to make. You know, it's not really that valuable to say, oh, yes, you will transcend something, or no, you won't transcend something, or you should or you shouldn't, because that just creates more confusion, right? The way to,
like,
let's say,
yeah,
right, the way to help mitigate confusion, which we're so good at, is right here, wherever here is, right now, whenever now is, we can attend to the curious nature of present experience. And that, you could say, with that agreement, that capacity, it flatlines, you know, hypotheticals. It flatlines causation.
Which kind of flatlines time.
Yes, 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 it can.
Yeah, like the imagination, I don't know. It all occurs right now. Like, the imagination of the time and the space.
Yes. Yes. This is a really very strange, very wild, very liberating observation, which is presence, whatever is appearing in or as presence, is the entirety of one's experience. And as we learn to be, let's say, non-clinging, which would suggest non-referential, right? If I stop placing any loyalty or emphasis or energy on anecdotal hysteria, on hypotheticalism, on explanations, justifications, or any form of reference or causality, then all of the energy that is consumed by creating hysteria can come to rest. And that energy then is available to feel itself. Right? This is a recognition of the plasma in the Dzogchen parlance would be the recognition of Rigpa, the basic space. And then to get a sense of yourself, which again is a feeling sense of yourself, your confidence is in feeling, not in thinking. You're like, oh wow, I am indeed, you know, a plasma of feeling. That's what's predominant. That's the truth in which attention occurs or appears, is feeling, presence. And everything else is an idea appearing in that presence, appearing in that plasma. But our conditioned reflex is that we need to make something of it. We need to make something of ourselves. We need to get it right to have some kind of aha, right?
Right.
But we don't. Yeah, I mean, it's like if you really give yourself up, then that would also include the interest or the need to have some kind of aha. and then all the evidence that you need is just this, rather than hoping that some kind of event or catharsis will occur in this to give you, you know, drop kick you into oblivion. I mean, how much simpler can it be than here this is? Here this is. Voila. That was easy.
I don't know. There has to be some... It does seem like there has to be some sort of interest. I don't know. It just does on its own.
Yes, the way that it wafts through your karma, right, is unique. You are coming out of the custom shop.
Yeah.
None of us rolls off an assembly line. The curious beatitude of waking up is everyone comes out of a custom shop with special pinstriping and chrome exhaust pipes. What so is already so, replete, complete, mysterious. All of the evidence that we are seeking for some recognition of awake is in our face. Once we introduce, I am not awake, I want to become awake, you're dreaming. And that I that's dreamed into place from nothing at all, the bad news is it can never be awake because it's apparitional. So you can begin to see how, let's say, loyalty and interest turns to thought, turns to reference making, to tell a story. And as we begin to be more acquainted with that, then we can retreat from that reflex. And by retreating from that reflex, then you're basically conscious of yourself as an attentive plasma, and permit, not that you can fuck it up or accelerate it, but we become comfortable residing in ourselves as an attentive plasma and relax from some kind of urgency that says, I want to wake up, because this... It's already awake. You've hit the Grand Slam and you've crossed home plate. Now it's just a matter of, a discovery of a textural subtlety, which you're quite capable of. Everyone is quite capable of, arguably anyway, to feel this. And it does seem to benefit from repetition. It benefits from, hanging out together and kicking it around, right? Talking it over, exploring what the feeling tone is that makes it look like I'm not there yet. Investigating that feeling tone and seeing what that feeling tone is made of and how hallucinatory it is. And so one's attention shifts from a feeling tone of regret or insufficiency to, oh my God, this plasma kicks ass.
You get a little taste of what it feels like to be a little more nourished than whatever thought gives you.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Because plasma is nourishing and, you know, thought is kind of, you know, it's calorically greedy. Thought shows up, right, instantaneously all throughout the day and night, dreaming, deep sleep, you know, waking state, whatever. And
those conversations you have with people are in that same sort of...
Yes.
It appears to reinforce whatever shit you've got going on in your mind.
Yeah, so imagine the Fuller Brush Man comes to your door and, you know, wants to get a foot in and sell you brushes or demonstrate a Kirby vacuum cleaner or sell you Mary Kay or Tupperware. Right? That's all that thought is capable of doing. All it can do is solicit. It's not real. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't refer to anything. It doesn't actually help us negotiate and navigate the, you know, the brilliance of life on Earth. It's just an after the fact attention seeking or soliciting mechanism. So we learn how to nonviolently, right? Simply close the door on thought and return ourselves to feeling what's present. That's what, you know, our dear Peter Brown refers to or suggests by saying, look over there. Rather than becoming embroiled in the story that thought is conjuring and the emotivity that thought may be stimulating, one can simply return to what's present without story, without reference. That's just one way that, you know, this shit works. It's not better or worse than anything else. It's a way, a style of hanging out and investigating the nature and texture of present consciousness. It has a certain kind of, you know, vitality and a certain kind of, you know, humor. It can be, you know, cathartic and transformative. That's why I do it. I could use all the transformation I can get.
I'm just tired of explaining what a loser I am to everybody. I'm like, this group, I don't have to do that, so I'm good.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Oh, I have to go through this again.
Yeah, no one has to go through the inventory of what a loser you are. We already get that.
Nobody cares. Good.
Yeah, that's right. Which brings me to a remarkable transition in our program. I think it brings us to a remarkable transition in our program. There we are. Bobblehead yoga. Everybody dance. Woo!